And welcome back to another episode of Minority Report's podcast and digital series. I am your host, Mona Sheikh. Happy Friday, everybody. Happy Friday. TGIF. Happy Friday, James. How you doing? Oh my God, this week has been like brutal. I don't know how it has been for you, but work-wise, stress-wise, it's been like a little crazy, but a good one nonetheless. I'm happy that the Friday is here, and I am so excited about my guest today. Not because only she's like part fellow Pakistani, but her accomplishments are so incredible that I think it's going to take me an hour just to read off her achievements. So I'll just give you a highlight. She's an incredible actress. She has been in The Good Place. She's been on the show FBI. She's been on We the People and the Boys. I mean, my God. I mean, her resume is like a gajillion miles long. But I'm just going to bring her on, and then we're going to talk about her incredible career. Here's my very talented friend, Anna Kaja. How are you?
Hey! It's good to see you.
So great to see you.
I feel like we both stepped out of the same salon.
We did. We stepped out of the awesome Pakistani hair salon. That's where we stepped out of.
Your stylist is a little better than mine.
No, I don't know about that. Yeah. I think we both got that whole thick hair, shiny thing going on. Yeah. Anna, your background is amazing. You are a mix of Indian, Pakistani, and Irish.
That's right. That's right.
You gotta give it to Pakistani men, though. They are out there spreading the word and spreading the seed, baby.
Oh, yeah.
Just out there making beige and khaki people.
Oh, yeah.
I am about that life.
Yeah.
Anna, your dad is Pakistani and your mom's Irish.
That's right. My dad was born in India. Then during the partition, went over to the newly formed country of Pakistan, and that's where he was raised.
I mean, what fascinates me is that how did your parents meet?
My parents met in Berkeley at an Israeli singles folk dance.
What? Israeli single folk dance?
An Israeli singles folk dance. I just said folks because you said folks. Yep, she wasn't wearing a bra. She saw her across the room. It was the 70s.
Hell yes.
You know?
Free the titties, baby. She's
free the titties. She had bright blue eyes.
He was like, man, I'm seeing those blue eyes. I'm seeing some free titties. I want to talk to that. There's a lot of freedom there. There's a lot of freedom. I want to check it out. Anna, your resume is so incredible. I think
what fascinates
me the most about you, that I mean, you are just such an accomplished actress. When I learned about you, I was like, my God, you've been like almost like flying under the radar. Like you've been doing so many amazing things, but you're like just flying under the radar and doing all these awesome roles. And I'm like, who is this incredible woman doing all these incredible roles? Like what? How did you even get
started?
That's
why I'm here, Mona. You got to be my radar. You got to be the radar that I'm
I got to be over. Your radar. I mean, Anna, how did you even get started? Like, I mean, are any of your parents artists by any chance?
No.
So what got you into acting? What made you go, you know what? I want to become an actress.
It's really just one of those, you know, I'm one of those people. It's the only thing I ever wanted to do. I remember being 2 years old. It was the only thing I ever wanted to do. 4 years old. Only thing I don't even remember the moment where I was like, hey, I could do that. Like people talk about that or, you know, or I'd like to do that or try that. It was the only thing I ever wanted to do.
Wow.
It's pretty straightforward to the point where like, I didn't really pursue other things. Like, you know, I never played a sport.
Right.
You know, I was just kind of like drama nerd.
Right. Did you ever watch like TV and were just like, you know what? I see myself doing that.
Oh, absolutely. Like I remember watching like Three's Company when I was really, 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 really little and just, you know, John Ritter was my guy. Oh, and I just wanted to do what he did. I only ever thought of myself playing the male roles, of course.
Really?
Yeah. Because, you know, especially back then, they were the complex roles. They were the interesting roles. They were the roles where it's like you're the center of your own life.
Right.
And not a prop, right? You're not a prop. Right. So you're the center of your own life. And that's how I felt.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember even in high school, like the monologues I would do were always, I did Hamlet. I was always doing male monologues. I remember that we did Our Town in high school, and like I come from a pretty, you know, conservative town, a little behind the curve. Yeah. Always.
Yeah.
We did Our Town, and you know, the stage manager who's the narrator, I told my drama teacher I was gonna audition for that, and she told me flat out, I will never cast a girl in that role. And then I auditioned, and I don't know, I guess she thought about it and she cast me.
Huh. Look at that. So. I mean, Anna, you're so young, like when you discover, I mean, from a very young age, were you just telling your parents, like, hey, I'm gonna be an actress, I'm gonna be a performer. This is what I'm gonna do.
Yeah.
And how
not
were they
like I'm it? Gonna be famous or anything like that, because I didn't have the knowledge to even really think about that.
Yeah.
Tell me about it. They were, I have to say, they were just incredibly supportive.
I mean, both your parents were.
Both.
Wow.
Both. My dad is sort of that. I'm an only child. Yeah. My dad is sort of like the not anti-Pakistani, but he's most non-traditional Pakistani you may have heard of his generation. He's in his 70s now, and he's, it's actually a very interesting story. He was considered like the young Sufi in the town.
Wow.
And people would like bring their kids to him to sort of heal or like have him predict soccer games and outcomes and stuff like that. And he was the one of the 9 brothers and sisters, and he had a twin who would go and to the mosque, you know, and during Eid, and he would just pray and meditate sometimes 3 a.m. all the time. He was extremely spiritual as a child. And then his parents had told him and his twin that they were not twins, that they were different ages.
Why is that?
Because my dad skipped 3 grades, and they thought, hey, let's tell Anna's dad that he's a little bit older than he is.
Wow.
I mean, so that his twin sister won't feel bad.
Right.
So anyway, something happened around teenage years. I don't know what it was, but he had like this whole break with the spiritual side of things and just went totally science minded. And he just said that he always knew he didn't belong there and he had to go. And he told his family that he had gotten some sort of, this is where it gets a little vague, but I think it was like a scholarship or some invitation to study at UCLA for, I think, a month.
Yeah.
And he says that they all like took him to the train, and he got on the train and he said, I'll be back in a month. And he waved, and he knew he was never going to go back.
Wow.
He did go back a couple times, but that was his, he knew he belonged somewhere else. Very, very strange. So good. He goes by way of some other places. He winds up, you know, Berkeley, California, doing a lot of psychotherapy, like back in the 70s.
Wow.
Like progressive psychotherapy, like Esalen shit. You know what I mean? And, and just totally obsessed with like that and trying to solve himself. And then he met my mom and got her into it. So he was just always different,
mm-hmm.
you know?
I mean, Anna, even like today's age for, you know, if you go and speak to a Pakistani dad and be like, what about therapy? Or even a Pakistani mom, they'll be like, I told my mom, and I was like, Ma, I think you should go to therapy. You've had a lot of trauma in your life. You should go to therapy. And my mom goes, I have a friend in the mosque. I'm going to talk to her. She's a therapist. I'm like, all right. Okay, cool.
Okay.
Couple of days pass by. I tell my mom, I was like, Mom, did you talk to your friend? She's like, did you talk to your therapist friend? She's like, I talked to her. She told me I am perfect.
Exactly.
I was like, I'm sorry, what? She told me I am perfect. And I was like, all right, then this conversation's over. Okay.
Exactly.
I should freaking go to my therapist and be like, give me my money back, because my mom said that she's perfect. So I don't have any issues. Give me my money back.
And you know what? She is. She is perfect.
She is perfect. Yeah. She's perfect in her own mind. She's freaking perfect, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and that is incredibly progressive. One thing I've come across is the Bay Area Indians and Pakistanis, like the South Asians in the Bay Area, are just incredibly progressive people. They're just on a whole different level of how they operate. Because I come back to LA and I come across South Asians here, not nearly as progressive. A lot flashier, a lot more conservative, a lot more backwards, I would say, in many ways.
Yeah.
But the Bay Area South Asians tend to be just so progressive.
Absolutely.
And I don't know why. Is it technology? I mean, what is that? What's that about?
I don't know. I mean, I think the Bay Area in general has a more progressive streak.
Yeah.
It has Berkeley in the 60s, right?
Yes.
In 1969 and all of that. I mean, LA is progressive because it's artsy and because it's metropolitan and it's sexy.
Yes.
I think there's a superficial, yes. I mean, I also, on my mom's side, I come from like a, I mean, sure, her family's more working class, but, or more like, I should say blue collar, not working class, blue collar. Mm-hmm. But like a lot of my family on my mom's side is like super, like they all went to Berkeley High mm-hmm. and graduated in 1969 and they're, you know, we're like, we invented Burning Man. You know, that's my family.
Wow.
Traveling to the desert to make giant art sculptures and that kind of stuff. So,
I mean, I don't, when you, now, have you been to Pakistan ever?
I have, yeah.
And what is it like? Well, how old were you when the first time you went back to Pakistan?
I was 38.
You were 38 years old.
I was 38 years old. And I went by myself.
Wow. What about your dad? He didn't want to go with you?
He didn't want to go with me, and I, and it took him that long to put me in touch with his family.
Huh.
Took him that long.
A lot of healing.
I went back, and I felt that I was not just healing my own life, like the unspoken schism of being raised by a human being that is from a place and a culture.
Mm-hmm.
Sprung from it, every cell, right?
Right.
Who really doesn't talk much about it and doesn't want to like share it with you. He'd talk about it a little bit, but if you push too hard or like, hey, how about I meet? Or hey, should we go? Or anything having to do with that.
Uh-huh.
And even my name, Kaja, which is on my birth certificate, that's a shortened version of... You're going to laugh at how I say it because you know this last name.
Khwaja.
But it's a shortened version of Khwaja, but that's what my dad shortened it to.
Wow. Yeah.
And so that's when he got me in touch with them. And so he gave me one phone number or email address. I emailed them. They were all, you know, cause all the rest of them are just all still right there.
Yeah.
Then I just found like, I was suddenly within a week in touch with hundreds of cousins, you know, first cousins and all sorts of people. And then within about 4 weeks of that, I had bought myself a plane ticket and my husband wanted to go with me. And I told him, no, there's something I have to do on my own.
Wow.
And they picked me up at the airport and that was it.
Wow. Anna, are you not scared in the process to be like, my God, I'm going to go to this strange country that my dad's from? That may not be the most politically stable or, you know, even safety-wise, not the most safe. I mean, none of those kind of concerns went through your head?
Yeah, they all went through my head, but I also just felt really strongly it was something I had to do. Like, it was a circle I had to complete. It was something I had to do in my life.
Yeah.
You know, meanwhile, I had written...
What was that need? Anna, what was that need you're talking about? Is that need to connect to your roots or to where your dad comes from? Is there a healing that you're doing on his behalf? Is this more of a personal healing?
Yes. All of that. There was a lot of it that I hadn't thought through, but just knew. But I, it's almost easier for me to explain it how it was when I was there. For instance, during my trip, I remember crying openly, like sobbing openly in front of people 6 different times. Mm. I'm not that person. Like, you're never going to see me cry, Mona. I mean, maybe on camera you'll see me, but like, I'm not that person that's the person that, you know, cries often. And I would even be like, why is this happening? Why is this happening? It was this very weird, like, body feeling of being home. And then answering all of these just answering the questions that they had.
Right. You know? Right.
Closing loops for them and bridging compassion and understanding, I think, I hope. That was my goal anyway. Am I explaining this well? Like, what it was like? It was just a need.
You're explaining it just fine. Yeah.
You know, it was just a need I had that I knew there was a part of me I could feel. Like I knew, but I didn't know. And I needed to bring those together in the full knowing.
Do you think it was about identity for you?
Totally. Totally. And as a writer, every story I tell, you know, when they say you tell the same stories over and over again, they're always identity stories. You know, it was about identity. Yeah.
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 Do you think it was about, I mean, I know that, you know, I think it's so fascinating. You're American born, raised, you know, you're partially of Pakistani descent. I'm born and raised in Pakistan. I moved to New York when I was 15, but then I went through like 10 years of identity crisis. I didn't know where I belonged. I was like, am I Pakistani? Am I American? Am I religious Muslim? Am I not religious Muslim? Like, what kind of Muslim am I? What kind of Pakistani am I? Am I even Pakistani? Because when I would go
That age sounds really challenging.
It's so rough. It is so rough.
Yeah.
You know, nobody prepared us. They just like threw us in this situation. My parents were just like, all right, gonna send the kids off to America. Have a nice day. Figure it out. And you're like, I don't know shit. Like, what am I gonna do? You know? I have four older brothers. We're only like 2 years apart from each other. So they're figuring their lives out as I'm trying to figure my life out. So I just went through 10 years of just not knowing where I belong. I remember going in 2006 when my father passed away. He died very young. My father died at 56. And I remember going to Pakistan and talking to my cousins and not being able to relate.
Yeah.
I couldn't relate to them. I was talking to them and I was like, you don't get me and I don't get you. Like, I know I was born partially raised here, but I have grown so much as a person that I'm really having a difficult time connecting with you. Was that a thing for you when you went and met your cousin?
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to relate because.
Oh, my God. It was just like, it literally felt like someone had like plunged me in the depths of the ocean and then turned me upside down. I had no bearings, you know? Oh. And I remember that there was, my dad had this one brother who had lived in the States for like a good chunk, like for 15 years of his adult life and then gone back. Right. Yeah. And I remember the first day, kind of asking about him, and they brought him over and just feeling like, you know, I just want to have, it's hard to explain the cultural divide, you know, but it felt like a safety to me. Just all the cues, all the emotional cues and the physical cues and the cues. Like, I had never knew I was so American until I went to Pakistan. You know what I mean? But I also never knew I was so Pakistani until I went to Pakistan. Like, at the same time, there was just this thing. Like, my bubby, my like older cousin's, you know, wife, he, you know, she just kept saying, she's like, you know, you're an Eastern girl wrapped in a Western girl. And like, and I think that's what I was like trying to bridge too, is because there was something that at the same time, even though I was like, I cannot relate. I appreciate, but I cannot relate.
Yeah.
There was another deeper part of me that was like, I've never felt more home. Like, never in my, like there's actually, I have these pictures of me with my family members, and I kind of, like, I remember I showed one to my husband and he was like, that's you. And it looked like my face was different. Like, the muscles in my face were different. And I looked like lighter and more open.
How,
like, in a lot of the pictures, just because there was a new relaxation in me of also being home. It was just really interesting to go back for me at that time.
I think, you know, I think for a lot of, and I hear this actually a lot from American, born kids who are either mix of Pakistani or Indian and any other culture, or who are born and raised here, is that sense of like longing, like that sense of longing to be like, yes. where do I, like, I long for this part of my life. I mean, did your dad raise you with like certain Pakistani things? Like, were you guys celebrating Eid? Were you guys doing Ramadan? Was he buying you Pakistani clothes?
No, like, none of it.
Nothing.
No. And in fact, I went on my own journey. Like, I found Pakistani kids. I found a community. And Indians. I actually like for a while joined a Bhangra troupe. You know, I in high school I found this like group of girls who were part of this place where you'd get hired to model saris. But I sought all of that out on my own. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he denied me things. He also kind of gave me a lot of things. Like, I can honestly say that my dad, and I think this is, well, you can tell me what you think. I think this is pretty impressive for someone of his generation raised in Pakistan.
Yeah.
He raised me with, I would say, zero sexism.
Wow.
Like zero.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
I remember him saying to me, he said, you know, Anna, marry whoever you want.
Wow.
But please don't marry a Pakistani because you are not made for that.
Wow. Like
he was worried. He was worried at a certain point.
Wow. That's huge. Did you not say to your dad, but dad, you're Pakistani?
Yeah. But he meant that, like, he wasn't an insult to Pakistanis at all. It was, oh shit, I raised this girl that can't do that. Like, I raised a very American girl, and he didn't necessarily, because he's from his generation, trust that a Pakistani man and this girl could, you know, coexist in a good way.
Right, right.
And I think a lot of that is generational.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, my brother, who is single, him and I talk, and he tells me the same thing. He's like, don't marry a Pakistani guy. And I was like, dude, you're Pakistani. You know?
There you go. Yeah.
And he's like, yeah. He's like, but yeah. He's like, but what you do and who you've become as a woman, he's like, there's not going to be any man really of our culture who will understand what is it that you do and who you are, you know? And listen, it's not to say that that guy isn't up there. Maybe he is. I just haven't met him, you know?
Most of the
Pakistani men I come across are, even if they're born and raised here, there's a nurturing by their family that they are, you know, they sit
little,
up top.
Little prince.
They're the kings, right? Yeah. They're the man. They call the shots, and they have to tell the woman what to do, you know? And I'm like, that's not going to work out for me because... Yeah. I don't take that from anyone. I mean, I've been on my own since I was 18, for God's sake. You know, I've been on my own for so freaking long. I mean, I know when you started your acting journey, like, how old were you when you said you were doing school plays, but then how old were you when you officially started taking acting classes and going to acting school and you were like, okay, this is like hard. This is where I'm going to do this.
Well, I was a theater major at UCLA because, you know, I'm going to be a theater major. And then, and then I just... I'm actually also a very late bloomer with the acting thing because in my 20s, I graduated from college. I had no money. I come from a family of teachers and I was like, I got to make a living. And so I went and I just immediately got hired as a high school drama teacher.
Wow.
At a high school down kind of, it's in Linwood. It's near like Compton and Watts, kind of squeezed between there. And I worked there for 4 years.
Wow.
And so I didn't, and then I had to sort of have a conversation with myself about like, wait a minute, you know, it's time to get serious. You got lost. Let's, you know, focus on the business and try to make a career for yourself. So I didn't even book my first acting job, I think, until I was maybe 29.
Wow.
Yeah. Like the 20s, I was taking acting classes and just sort of trying to figure out how to exist and make money. But I think I'm kind of a late bloomer.
Yeah.
Like I didn't know how to navigate the business.
Right.
You know?
I mean, when you don't come from the business, it's, you know, you're
really overwhelming.
It's very overwhelming. And you just kind of have to, in a layman word, like, you just kind of have to eat shit on your own and just figure it out. You're just like,
you really do.
You just gotta, you know, you're like, you're saying that. So what was the first break that you got at 29?
I was cast in a play at the Mark Taper Forum.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. Written by David Hare. And it was Gordon Davidson, who was the artistic director of, for 35 years there. It was his last hurrah before he retired.
Wow.
And yeah, it was called Stuff Happens. And yeah. I remember we had a cast of like, basically I had decided to start taking my career really seriously. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I was going to run it like a job. So I had started this group of people, an accountability group, and we met every week and we had tasks. And the whole thing was like, the reason you make 90% of the money is because you do 90% of the work. You know, mm-hmm. like if you're a working actor or a working comedian or singer or whatever the person wanted to be, you're working if you did the work to get the job. So if you're doing the work, like look at all that you've created, Mona. If you're doing that kind of work to create things for yourself, then you are working. And you should have that. You should leave each day with that kind of self-respect. So I have been doing that for 6 months.
Yeah.
And feeling that I was making progress, feeling better. I felt that I was going into audition rooms with a different kind of attitude, a different kind of confidence mm-hmm. from that. And so then I got that play at the Taper. And I remember that at the table read, the director went around and like everybody else, I swear to God, everybody else in this play was like 18 or 20 of us was, you know, famous, like heavy hitters, like Broadway, like the Lion King, or, you know, like they, each of the movie stars, I won't go through like all the list and everything. And I remember like the director going around and shaking each person's hand and doing that, like, you know, we're all amazing and famous, congratulatory, like thing, you know what I mean? And then he came to me and he was like, you slipped in, huh? I was like, yeah, I slipped in.
I mean, was it like intimidating for you the first time? Like you're sitting with all these like heavy hitters, and then you're like,
totally. Right,
this is my first gig. Hey,
totally. Yeah. Hey, I know what I'm doing. Yeah. Like, you know.
I mean, Anna, you know that in the acting world, like acting is a lot cruel. A lot more cruel to actresses than it is to actors. Like a male actor can work till like he's 85 and about to croak, and they'll be like, he's nominated for an Oscar. And then, you know, but for women, it's like this kind of expiration date about because of youth and because Hollywood is such a, you know, youth driven thing. I mean, for you at 29, where you're like, oh my God, I'm getting older. Are they even going to hire me at this point?
Terrified. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were lots of things like that because I'm old enough to where I remember when there really was no one that looked like you or me,
right,
on screen. You know what I mean? Right. And right. And the first characters that I played were named Lupe and Maria. You know, there have been so many like reincarnations of what's okay in this business. Right. Then of course, like no one was going to cast me in Latina roles anymore, and that's wonderful. Yes. And then, you know, after 9/11,
yeah,
unfortunately,
we had to become famous.
This sliver opens up where you get to play terrorists and wives of terrorists. And mm-hmm. And I remember those audition rooms where like, and I remember going in them and then thinking, you know, like, I think I'd better start wearing a headscarf. I think it'll make me stand out. You know what I mean? And like having just trying to.
In auditions or in personal life?
In auditions.
Okay. Okay.
In auditions. Yeah.
And did it?
Yeah, it did. Because there wasn't any nuanced understanding of Muslim identity, the spectrum of Muslim identity.
Right.
Muslim female identity.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Which is a very broad spectrum.
That's correct. You can go from a bikini wearing Muslim woman to all the way up to a burqa wearing Muslim woman.
And I have cousins who do both.
Well, I
have that, and I have that.
Precisely.
That's right.
Precisely. Yeah. Precisely. Exactly. So there's, yeah, 100%. I know there are a lot of male, like Muslim actors and South Asian actors, whatever. They always complain. They're like, you know, I got sick of like getting cast as terrorists, or I got sick of it, or I refused to audition for it. Is that something that was going through your mind where you were like, you want to watch? You're like, fuck this. I'm not going to play another terrorist wife, or I'm not going to audition for another.
No, not just terrorist wife, but also terrorist.
Right.
I played terrorists. I don't feel good about it. I played women that hid bombs. Mm-hmm. Then I played women that we thought were terrorists, you know, as it all, and a lot of times, of course, I just played like the weak wife. I've, you know, spoken 10 languages on camera. And, you know, and just the weak wife who probably doesn't say much.
Right. Right.
And then, you know, I'm like, as people sort of, as it started to evolve, then I remember that I played someone that was, you know, suspected of being a terrorist, but wasn't a terrorist. And then I remember being on a TV show where I was on the mother of two sons, and like one son is being tried. And I was like, you know, no, I'm telling you, my son is not a terrorist. He's not a terrorist. And then the prosecutor is like, but what about your other son? Okay, my other son is a terrorist, but his son is not a terrorist. And I was like supposed to be showing both, you know. And I was like, how many times can I do this? And then I finally got to the point where I remember like the last job I took that was just, I was a mullah's wife, you know, and I remember just like, I took it for the money, and I felt gross about the whole thing. And
what show is this?
I'd rather not say. And then, you know, I just like took a piece of my paycheck and I kind of donated it to Human Rights Watch. Cause I just felt like it felt wrong, you know?
Mm-hmm. So do you feel Anna, like when these roles, you know, there's a big conversation now. I mean, of course, now it's a lot bigger conversations than it did. I mean, right after September 11th, about the, you know, the rewriting of the narrative, right? Constantly putting people like us like in these boxes to be like, Mona's only gonna play like I had the casting director of Ugly Betty, whose class I took in New York City, and he sat me down, and I'll never forget this, Anna. He looked me straight in the eye and he said, Mona, I'm so sorry to tell you this, but you're brown, so you'll never be the lead in anything. He's like, you'll be the third or the fourth banana. You'll play a terrorist wife or a terrorist mother. And that's kind of about it for you. And I remember looking at him being like, okay, cool, awesome. This is my entire career? But I know so much of it has changed. I mean, as it is, you know, prevalent.
So
in
much.
So much. The nuanced conversations are happening. They're no longer casting, you know, you know, an Indian woman as, you know, a Saudi woman. It's just like, that's not happening. They're trying to actually make an effort to go for Arab speaking actresses to be like, let's bring you in and put you in.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. And not just that, they're now, you can be the lead. You can be the number one on a TV show that has nothing to do with the fact that you're South Asian. Or can weave that nicely into the fabric of who you are in a very natural way, you know?
Right.
It's amazing how far we've come. And yes, there's farther to go.
Yeah.
When you asked me about, you know, were you worried that by the time you're 29, it's like, I'm already too old. Mm-hmm. I was always terrified of that, but I really see that changing too. You know, I mean, I feel that people are finally starting to make strides to combat this ageism, this unspoken ageism that's taking place in this business at all times, you know? And I think that that's wonderful.
Yeah.
I feel like the age of woman that you see on TV right now, if you were to take the median age, yes. I haven't studied this, but it's gotta be higher.
Yes.
You know?
I mean, now you have like your likes of Helen Mirren, you know, like kicking ass and like looking sexy. And you're like, look at Helen Mirren. Helen Mirren's hot. Like,
I'm so fucking sexy. Yeah.
She's amazing. I just adore her. I mean, I know when
she's my favorite.
She's so great. She's so great. Yeah. I know when you started doing bigger shows and started getting bigger roles, Did that kind of, I mean, what would you say was that one big role at, and at what age was it where you were just like, you know what? I've officially now made it. Like, now I am in the zone of things. Like, I'm going to keep getting work because of this.
Mona, I never had that role. I feel like my career trajectory, I mean, my career trajectory, it is a trajectory, you know, like what I'm working on right now, the show that I'm working on right now, to me, it feels like I'm excited about it and it's a step up for me and I can't talk about it yet.
Okay.
But
you write it? Did you write and produce?
No. Okay. It's just that I signed an NDA and it'll be out in like a bit. But you know, like my, you know, people's like their careers are like, right? Mine is the slow, like lowest slope in the world. Like this is my career. But it does, you know. And sometimes when I'm down or if I have a bad dip, you know, or months or something like that, my husband always says to me, he's like, look at the XY graph. Just look at it. Look at it. Step back and look at the XY graph. It really is. It's like this little. So it's there's. I didn't have what I would call a breakout role. You know, there are shows that I've been on that I think are higher pedigree that people really love. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those roles that I played there don't coincide with the roles that I'm really proud of, which are on, you know, shows that for whatever reason people in our business don't think of as great or anything like that. I would say the most empowering thing that I ever did that I do feel just helped me as an actor was creating my own solo show and taking it off Broadway.
And which solo show is this?
So it's called Shahid, The Dream and Death of Benazir Bhutto.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad we're organically transitioning into that because, I mean, look, I grew up when Bhutto was in power, right?
Yeah. And you were there, right?
I was there. I grew up under the Bhutto era. And, you know, just as a side note, Pakistan has had a female prime minister. India has had a female prime minister. America has yet to have a female president. And it's really alarming. It's really shocking to be like, how are we the world power and we claim the drum and beat the drum of democracy around the world and yet we can't get a freaking female president?
That's so true. And then, of course, people would argue with you and say, but that's because it's dynastic politics over there. You know, it's because her father and it's because they elect families and et cetera, et cetera. I'm not saying it's true. I'm just saying that's...
Yeah, for know, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, people can make that argument, but what made you do the one woman show, Shahid? Why Shahid? What was that thing about Benazir for you?
I just found her to be so fascinating, such an enigma. Mm-hmm. And there was this book that I read by Ron Suskind called Way of the World. He won a Pulitzer Prize for it. And he followed her around in the last days of her life. And that was a very like, cruxy time for her, you know what I mean? And what he captures, in my opinion, in that book that I wanted to capture in the play was how complex she was. Because, you know, as you know, everyone has a strong opinion about Benazir Bhutto, right? She's a saint. She's the devil. She's a corrupt monster, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Blah, blah, blah. Yes. Or she, you know, we bow down and we kiss her feet and we walk 10 miles to meet her at the airport and all of that. And I was interested in the multiple truths at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the story that the play itself is, I played 8 characters and four of them are real.
Did you write it? Oh, wow. You wrote it. Amazing. Yeah.
Four of them are real. I played Condoleezza Rice. I play Fatima Bhutto.
Wow.
Who is Benazir's niece and who believed that Benazir had her father killed. Mm-hmm. I play a woman, this Israeli woman, Benazir's best friend. And then I play Benazir. And then I play fictional characters that Benazir would have come across in her life. And it all takes place on the last day of her life before she goes out into Rawalpindi Park and makes her final speech and then is killed. And so my take was that she was corrupt. She didn't mean to be corrupt. Mm-hmm. She started out with hope and purpose and vision.
Yeah.
And did care, but that she was slowly corrupted because of money, because of privilege, because it's hard to be the female prime minister and everyone's working against you all the time. Pakistan is just a gridlock of politics. Just a gridlock. And that she, maybe not her best sides had come out over different periods of her life, but that when she returned to Pakistan and Condoleezza Rice had brokered that agreement, she came back finally that third time to make up for it. And to become the person that those millions had believed she was all along. And that she was perhaps willing to become a Shaheed. Mm-hmm. If necessary to do that, because she knew she was putting herself in danger.
Right.
And so it's her reconciling all of that and making the choice to know that this may be the last day of her life. And she's stepping out there because of, to pay the price for wrongdoings and to finally try to save Pakistani people.
Oof, that's heavy, Anna. That's heavy, you know. I'll tell you my experience growing up under the Bhutto era. I remember my father taking me to the airport because I traveled by myself from Karachi to New York. And I remember my father being at the red light. I'm in the car with my mom and my dad. And there's a car behind us. And they have Kalashnikovs sticking out of their windows. Tinted car, completely tinted car. You can't see who's sitting inside. They have Kalashnikovs sticking outside the window and they're shooting up in the air. And that's what these young men would do during the Bhutto time, is the amount of corruption was unbearable. I mean, it was just simply unbearable. They would just show up to, you know, these thugs, these goons would just show up to your, you know, they would show up to my dad's business and be like, hey, my dad had a car showroom business and, you know, my dad had a car driving business. So he owned a lot of cars. So they'd just walk up and be like, yeah, I'll take that car and I'll take that car. My dad's like, the fuck you will. The fuck out of here. Wow. My dad was like, get the fuck out of here. You're not taking shit. And he's like, I'm going to fucking come and I'm going to arrest you. My dad's like, yeah. Fucking come back and arrest
me. Do you think that was like a product of Zardari?
That's a product of Zardari. That's because, you know, he's like corrupt as hell. Yep. You know, and I remember as a kid, even remember watching the foreign delegates coming to meet Benazir and Zardari. And Zardari would be sitting on the couch with like his leg up like this, like all like ghetto style. And we used to be like, yo, what kind of ghetto ass shit is this? Like as a kid, I remember watching it as a teenager being like, yo, that's some ghetto shit. Like sitting with your leg up, like while you're meeting a Japanese. You mean the president of Japan? Like what? She was, I think,
so disrespectful.
I think what I always admired about Benazir Bhutto is how incredibly articulate she was, how incredibly well spoken she was, how educated she was. Sure. I mean, also besides her, how beautiful she was. But I think for us, you know, what we saw. Her words didn't match her actions. Like, Benazir Bhutto for the longest time would be like, hum aapko yahan pe sakoon chahte hain, meaning I want peace in this country. And it's just like, dude, how is it that people are fucking getting robbed every day, Benazir? If you talk about peace, then why are you not cracking down on these people?
Yeah.
And eventually reports were going out that all these thugs and goons were released from prison on one condition, that they would go and rob people and bring the goods back and they would get to split it between, you know, Zardari and his goons and these corrupt people.
That was the condition.
I mean, that's how bad. Zardari was called Mr. 20% because whatever deals would come in, he would get 20% of the cut. It's like, why are you getting a cut of this?
Yeah.
You know?
And it seems like she was just a talking head, just a pretty talking face sometimes. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, look, you know this already. She went through a hard time. I mean, she was in prison. They put her, they threw us in jail for the longest time. God knows what they did to her. God knows how they treated her that she never even talked about. Like they had to have sexually assaulted her. They had to. They had all this power. These men, this is a highly toxic, patriarchal, misogynistic environment. You think they're not going to put their hands in, you know, in the cookie jar a little bit? Oh, yes, they will.
Oh, absolutely. And there are no regulations. I mean, there may be regulations, but they're not necessarily going to be followed as far as...
That's right. They're not enforced.
Torture, et cetera. She said that she believed she lost some of her hearing. Wow. From that, and also from so much solitary confinement. She spent not just prison, but a lot of time in solitary confinement.
Right.
And then what they did to her father, and...
That's right.
You know.
Who was hung. I mean, yep. Zhao Hak is the one who hung him.
And then
Zhao Hak was... I remember the day I learned that Zhao Hak was dead. I remember I was in the shower. I was a kid. I was like, maybe... I don't know. I was under 11 years old. I remember being in the shower, hearing that Zhao Hak had been killed in a plane crash. And all they found were his teeth. That's all they found. That's how they identified him. I remember that.
Funny that all they found was the thing you can use to identify someone.
That's funny. That's the only thing they found to identify someone. Exactly. Exactly. I don't even know if they found a black box or whatever. But I mean, for you, Anna, when you were playing all these different roles, I mean, A, you've written these roles out. I mean, for you, did you, I don't know, like, is it hard? Are you one of those actors that is like, you know what? I'm not going to judge the character. I'm just going to play it in its authentic truth. Like Tom Cruise talks about it a lot. Maybe it's not the right comparison, but Tom Cruise says, I never judge the character. I just play the role. I do not judge the character. I just look at it. I just live, like, try to bring as much authenticity and truth for the character in that moment.
Yeah, of course. Of course, because that character believes that they're justified good. And good and doing the right thing, and they're struggling, and they are feeling all sorts of things and want what they want and are offended and angry and hurt or ecstatic or manic or whatever, you know, and more or less aware of the people around them and how they're affecting them and all of that. Yeah. Yeah, of course. Of course.
Yeah. I mean, Anna, do you... you know, there's these different levels in Hollywood. Well, there's the working actors you've seen in tons of stuff. You know, you kind of know their name, but not really. But they're working actors. They make a lot of money. You'll see them all over the place, you know. Then there's the next level. It's like, you know them. You know, they have had like maybe one breakthrough role or maybe two breakthrough roles. But, you know their name, but kind of not know their name. Like, you know, oh, my God. Yeah, that guy from that show, you know, or that girl from that show. And then there's your mega stars, right? There's your superstars or whatever. I don't know. Do you feel like you're more of a working actor? You are more somewhere in between a mega star and, oh, I know her from that show person.
Well, what I'm certain of is that I'm not a megastar. I know for sure. I'm gratefully a working actor. I've been on, I think, over 50 television shows. I've recurred on a good number of them. I would have to go back and look. Yeah. So I guess I think I'm like that woman. But I think sometimes people don't recognize me. You know what I mean? Because sometimes... who knows if my hair is back? Who knows if I'm playing, in someone's, Indian mother and, who's a bad, of course, listen, Beta, I just want you to, yes. And someone who's like 55, you know, or if I'm playing someone who's like maybe 39 or whatever it might be. And, or the FBI agent or those different things. So I think I'm probably in that. I'm at that point where I notice that like whatever set I go on, I'm like, oh, you again. Oh, you. You know, I know that I've worked with you, hairstylist. This is our fourth time working together. Or, this show I'm working on right now in another state where I'm just flying back and forth. Yeah. There's three actors on that show that I've worked with before.
Wow.
So it's starting to feel that the world is starting to feel small for me.
Because that pool of working actors is also a small pool, is it not?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm realizing that it is.
Yeah.
I'm realizing that it is.
Yeah. I mean, now, Anna, with all these live streams, you're not only do you have your major studios and your music, major networks, now you have all these live, you have all your streaming services, your Hulu, your Netflix, and your Paramount Plus and your Disney Plus.
And your YouTube.
and TV your YouTube. Shows. I mean, my God, Apple TV. Yep. So much content is being put out. Are you seeing a shift in roles for you where you are no longer required to be like, hey, can you put on an accent for that? Or are you more and more
absolutely
just where you're just absolutely like, I'm just going to talk like I do, the way I talk with an American accent?
Yeah, yeah. And also just because I sort of feel like I've paid my dues. Not that there's anything. Mm. The thing is, I love playing characters with accents and I love doing accents. That's the thing. It's actually something I greatly enjoy. But I think on my artistic journey, just because I'm a solo, I've done 3 solo shows, right? And right. when you do solo shows, you play a lot of different people. You're an actor where, you know, I've played men. I've played old people, young people. I played a little girl in my show. Mm-hmm. So you're used to stretching, right? You're used to mm-hmm. playing that character over there. And for me personally, and maybe this circles all the way back to our discussion about why I had to go to Pakistan and all that, I feel like for me personally, I'm trying to come home.
Mm.
And so the roles that are interesting me more, that I'm more compelled by, that I want to audition for, that I'm not okay saying no to, are ones that are just using more of me, how I am, me.
Right.
This Anna, not all the other sort of Annas, like, but this, and delving into her and mining that seems to be what interests me right now.
Right. Right. I mean, these roles you go for, are you auditioning for them or they're just offered to you? I mean, you have over 50 television credits, for God's sake.
It depends. I still most of the time audition, but every once in a while, it's always a great day.
Wow.
When somebody calls me and I'm like, hey, I have a booking for you. Then, of course, I have to see if I want to take it. But that's always nice.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, because you put in so much work at this point and you have built all this incredible resume and this body of work. I would think that you are at this point where you're just like, all right, let me take a look at the script. If I like it, if I see I can, you know, I like it, I'll do it. If not, then I'm not.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because I do. I feel like I've paid my dues. If you want me to play an Indian mom.
Yeah.
She better be a really, really interesting Indian mom with an arc that I haven't seen before.
Right.
Or pay me some money, a lot of money.
Just pay me a lot of money. That's all.
I feel like I'm okay saying no to things. I'm okay. I'm more interested in what interests me than trying to please out there.
Right, right.
And that's that again on my little XY graph has been a slow shift.
Right.
So
James asked, can Anna mention how she broke into TV if she doesn't mind?
Well, hi, James. Broke in. I just did it the old fashioned way. I got an agent and a manager, and then I started auditioning. And I remember when I booked my first role on a TV show from a long time ago called For the People. Not the one that you mentioned, but a different one called For the People.
Oh, and, really? There was another one.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember I called my dad. I was like, dad, I'm going to be on TV. I got my first role. he was like, how do you know this? He wanted to be absolutely sure, you know.
Have they paid you yet? Did they cut you?
I know, no.
You're like, no, Dad, that's not how it works. I gotta
I know first. Exactly.
Because you know, like South Asian parents are always like, how much does it pay you?
Absolutely.
My mom will just call me up. She's like, how much money did you make last year? How about none of your business? How about that, mother? Like, what?
Yeah.
You know,
and then I just like started getting different. I started out getting the co-stars. And then at a certain point I decided that I wanted to stop saying yes to those. And someone gave me a good piece of advice, which they said, you know, they said, the only way to tell people that you are at a higher level and you want to start doing guest stars is to stop taking co-stars. And soon enough, they'll get the message.
Okay.
So I told my reps, that's what I wanted to do. And then there was a little dip where I was scared, and then I started getting larger auditions, you know, auditions for larger things.
How many co-star roles do you have to get before you say, I'm not doing co-star roles?
Well, everybody's journey is different. I think some people, I think if you're 22, you just graduated from college, my recommendation would be go straight to a big agency and tell them, I'm only taking series regular roles, and just see if you can just jump right over there, you know? Mm. But the way I did it was I kind of had to like go up, you know, each rung of the ladder.
Right.
You know, not a lot of fire escapes for me. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know when you got your agent, was there a conversation about what are you? What do you mix of? What is that name? What is that last name? Kaja. Did they ask you to change your last name to change it to an Irish name?
I wish someone would ask me to play an Irish role. I would love to do that.
You'll get more bookings if you're not that ethnic. That's what I was told.
Definitely. Well, I remember the moment in my 20s when it's like the fog had parted from my eyes, and I was like, I looked at TV. It was as if I was looking at it for the first time in my life, and realized that people on TV didn't look like me.
Wow.
You know? But then slowly after that, that started to change. And I got in that like slivery headscarf.
Yeah.
You know, it's horrible what that person said to you, you know?
Oh yeah, you're only ethnic. You're never gonna be, you'll be the second or the third or the fourth banana. He calls me a banana.
Yeah, I can't tell you how much I feel that, because I think every actor and any minority actor has those moments.
Yeah,
where it suddenly hits you. It's like I don't know. You just have these people tell you these sort of heartbreaking things. Like it's like they want to take your hope.
Yeah.
And your drive and the purpose, the calling you were born with, and they want to snap it. And
that's right.
And the thing is that look around. Everyone has created their own path. Everyone has created their own paradigm. I mean, that casting director didn't know that what we saw on television right now was going to look like what it is.
That's correct.
And we don't know what it's going to look like in the future. So or she didn't know.
That's right.
Didn't have a right to tell you that.
That's right. I mean, because it's an ignorant statement. It's like me sitting here trying to predict what the next 10, 15 years of Hollywood is going to look like. I don't know.
Absolutely.
It's probably going to be a lot more diverse, but I don't exactly know what that's going to be.
And they're also summing you up. It's an objectification of you while they're talking to you as a human being. It's like telling you that you're second, third, fourth. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I actually quit acting for a long period of time. I just stopped going to auditions. I just stopped going to acting because it really broke my heart. Like before I moved from New York, I was with a manager and I was up for this lead role in an independent feature film. The budget was about $1 million or so. And I went in for like a producer and director session like 3-4 times. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, make up your fucking mind already. Like, what do people want from me? And they finally ended up giving a role to another, you know, actress, an Indian actress. And my manager told me, and the reason they didn't hire me, Anna, I kid you not, I've talked about this a few times, is because I wasn't hot enough. They did not think I was hot enough. And guess what? This hot actress that they hired, she was so bad. They had to cut her out from most of the movie. They were like, we literally wasted our time and money. We could have just hired Mona and she could have done a way better job. So I was just like, all right, well, you want to help. And it broke me. Something inside me just broke. And I was just like, I'm no longer going to go to auditions. Fuck auditions. I'm just going to do stand-up. And honestly, I'm very grateful that I took that path because I feel like being a stand-up made me a better actor. It also did put me down this path of like bitterness. You know, some people become bitter because this is a rough business. It's a lot of rejection. And it took me away from that because it gave me so much control over my
own career. It
empowered me like crazy. Because I was no longer like this.
It's like the biggest fuck you.
It's the biggest.
You know, it's just the biggest fuck you. It's the biggest taking of your space. It's the biggest arriving.
Yep. I was just like, you don't get to define my life in any form or shape. I get to define my own life and I get to define my own creativity. And, I, you know, Listen, it's been hard. A stand-up is hard. This is such an unsexy business, but on the front, it looks like such a sexy business. Behind the scene is so fucking unsexy. Don't you think, Anna?
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. It's really almost blue collar. I mean, if people that aren't in this business had any idea how many times a person shoots a scene, that alone, I mean, you know, sometimes I'll see background actors on the set who, you know, it's their first day of background and they're like, excuse me, miss, are we doing it again? I'm like, oh, we've just started. we're 5% through the way we're going to shoot this scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get ready to walk up those stairs and back down those stairs about 150 more times.
That's right.
I'm so sorry.
Exactly.
You know, like, I'm sorry, exactly. But that's just how it is.
Exactly.
Before lunch, after lunch.
And I did extra work once, maybe twice. And
that's
I made
the
a
way
promise.
To do it.
And I made a promise to myself, nope, never again. Not doing this. Nope, not doing this. I'm better than this. I have much more talent and much more things to offer than this. I'm not going to do it. And, you know, it's interesting, Anna. Like, it goes back to that point you were making about, hey, you want to move on to bigger roles? Then you got to start rejecting co-stars. You can be like, listen, I've done this already. I need guest star roles. I need lead roles. Like, send me for, you know, those are the kind of stuff that I'm going for. It's almost like you have to claim it. You have to command it to be like, this is what I'm worth. This is what I am.
That's right. God, it's so true. And honestly, I would say that it's almost everything. Do you have to have the talent? Yeah, you got to have some talent.
Yeah.
You know, does it help if you look a certain way? Yeah, it probably helps if you look a certain way. Although that's changing too. Yeah. But it's your journey of learning how to claim what you want and expand what you truly believe you deserve.
Yeah.
Is the journey. I mean, honestly, if I look at my career, if I'm being really honest, mm-hmm. I didn't book a job until I was 29. Because I didn't in myself know how to claim that. Mm. I didn't, you know, when it's been, I'm a slow burn because my own internal growth has been a slow burn. Mm-hmm. And I feel like my career is to an extent an outward reflection of my internal relationship with my career, you know?
Right, right. You know, Anna, I believe that, I think as women, especially, it probably happens for a lot of male actors too, but I feel as women, especially when you come from certain cultures, I mean, I can definitely say for myself, I mean, my journey to just even become, to even put it out in the ether that I want to be a performer was a fucking nightmare. It was
That's
a nightmare.
Right.
And my family gave me an ultimatum. My brothers, when I came out of my artist closet, I told my brothers, I said, because my brothers lived here, my parents lived in Pakistan, and I told my brothers, I was like, I want to be a performer. Like, I really don't want to go to college. I want to go to acting school. Like, I don't want to waste my time and my effort, like, and my money. Like, I'd rather go to acting school. And my brothers straight out gave me an ultimatum. They said, either you're going to go to college and you're going to become a physical therapist, or we're going to send you back and mom's going to marry you off to someone. That's it. Those are your options.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Take your pick. Like, these are your options, right? So for me, I had to fight all these cultural norms. I had to fight familial norms. I had to fight my own internal demons. Like, my journey has just been so chaotic and so fucked up that it's taken me such a long time to finally be able to stand and just claim and just give myself permission. Just give myself permission to be like, you, I bless thee. Just go fucking do it. Just do it. Do it. And I think for us, I think for each individual artist, I think it's such a journey to come to that acceptance, to come to that place to be like, I give permission to myself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And sometimes that's what I think people that aren't in the business might not see is just how much it takes to do for some people. Like, I guess what I'm saying is, for instance, if you're a kid of an artist, if you're a kid of a famous person or someone in the business,
yeah,
you don't just have an advantage because you have connections and that kind of stuff, and perhaps already money, which is a big fucking help.
Yep.
If you don't have to work the day job, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right.
But really, what was, I think it's, what's most is it was implanted in you that you could, you know, the doubts, the self-doubts just aren't as loud, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or the external doubts, or you who literally, literally fought people saying no. I mean, they, I mean, a threat of imprisonment. I mean, really, like,
right.
you fought off very real threats.
Right.
You know? And then I'm sure once you fought those off, they still remain inside you. You know, you were raised with those. And the journey you've been on to fight those off and to claim yourself, as you're saying, and to be here as Mona Shaikh.
Yes.
Doing this, hosting your own show. You know?
Yeah.
It's heroic, I think. I mean, aww. I don't mean to exaggerate, but it really is.
You're very kind. You know,
it's heroic on a soul level.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, I consider myself, I think when you go through so much shit in your life at an early age on, I think either you become, I think you either become bitter or you become spiritual. I chose to be on the more spiritual path. And Gary Zukav, who's an amazing, writer about spirituality, he talks about that when your personality matches your soul's purpose, is when you are in perfect alignment with yourself. That's when you do the greatest things in your life, is when your personality comes in to support your soul's purpose. And I
love that.
I 100% believe that. I mean, how is it that a 2-year-old Anna knows that she wants to be an actress? Because that's Anna's soul's purpose. But now Anna's personality has to catch up to that soul's purpose so she can be in complete alignment with herself.
Yeah, and maybe her personality even was caught up. But maybe then it started to get separated from outside forces.
Sure, 100%. And then Anna has to step in and be like, no, 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 I can't let that get away. I have to be in complete alignment with my personality and my soul purpose.
I love that.
Gary Zukav's amazing. You should look him up.
He's really, I will.
Yeah. Do you listen to Super Soul Sunday at all? Oprah's?
No, I don't. But I love Oprah.
Anna, Super Soul Sunday has literally changed my life. It is hands down one of the best podcasts on the planet. It's just so brilliant. She brings on everyone. Like, she brings on anyone you can possibly think of, the creme de la creme of humanity. And she talks to them about their spiritual journey. And then she, in return, talks about what she's learned and, you know, how she's come. I mean, Anna, for God's sake, I mean, I'm sure you know Oprah's life story. I don't know if you know.
Of course, yes.
She was raped. God, kicked out by her mother. I mean, she just comes from so much adversity. And for her to be standing where she is today is simply nothing short of miraculous. I mean, it's just brilliant. And I think when you get on that kind of, as an artist, even if you're an artist or not, but I think especially when you're an artist, because I feel like being an artist is such a spiritual journey, at least it is for me. When you get in that place, I mean, the fact that you start discovering these things, about you. I mean, for the longest time, I used to look on the outside for answers. I'd be like, can somebody please give me answers? Like, I'm lost. I'm confused. Yep. Can you give me answers? It's only when I started looking inwards is when I found all the answers.
Yep.
Do you feel that way? Has that been a thing in your journey?
Absolutely. I'm a Vedic meditator. I meditate 40 minutes a day total.
Oh, amazing.
And I've been doing that for 3.5 years. And I find it to be the most important thing in my life. Mm. I still fall into all the same traps. Maybe just the tipping point has happened recently where I'm just what you said, looking inward more.
Yeah.
But it's just, I think it's just our human nature that we want something on the outside to make us happy, to make it better, to make us satisfied. Mm-hmm. And then in this business, I think it's exponential. You know what I mean? Like, the answer's out there. Give me a role. Give me a role so I can post about something. You know, give me.
Give me a role so I can validate to myself that I'm worthy. That I'm worthy, that I actually have the talent, that I'm not like bullshit myself in my head, like, oh, how awesome I am.
Exactly. Yeah. That's it.
That role is going to really validate it for me. That's going to validate
it. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
But the thing is, that just becomes more and more short-lived. Mm-hmm. Even if it does validate it, it's not, it disappears, and then you need more, and then you need more, and then you need more, you know?
Yeah.
It's whatever, like, it is, think about all the things you said, if I could just, and then you get it, and you're just like, but if I could just, mm-hmm. but if I could just, you know, look at that person, they have that, and all they're thinking is, if I could just, mm-hmm. but it's really, and also I did The Artist's Way recently. I don't know if you've done it.
Mm-mm.
It is so incredible, by Julia Cameron. It's been around for like 30 years.
What is it, Anna?
It's a 12-week program. It's called The Artist's Way.
Okay.
It's a spiritual program for artists and creatives.
Oh.
You commit to it, you do it for 12 weeks, and it opens up your life. It's
wow.
It's beautiful. Wow. And it gets you back in touch with the creative child inside of you. It doesn't matter if you're a work in finance, you don't have to be an artist. It doesn't matter if you're already a famous writer. Anyone can do it. Mm. And you start adding, you know, it's the basis of all of it is that life is creativity. Life, we are creations. We are based in creativity.
Yeah.
Our purpose fulfillment, whatever it is that means the most to us, raising our children, gardening, whatever it is, these things are creative acts, and they are a communion with the divine. They're a communion with something beyond us, whatever you want to call it, or greater than us, or that unites us.
Yes.
And it's a step-by-step program to get you out of this shit and recentered into that.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps you start kind of carrying that joy of creativity with you.
Yeah.
Wherever you go.
Anna, what is meditating 40 minutes a day? First of all, when you started off meditating, did you start off with 40 minutes, or did you start off with 5 minutes and 10 minutes?
I started off with 40 minutes, but I'll tell you why.
Wow.
I tried meditate a bunch of different kinds of meditation, and I could never stick with them. And I found it really hard. Like, sitting quietly with my own thoughts was hell. It was hell. And sometimes I could do 5 minutes or 10 minutes, but I would resist it. And then I was introduced to something called Vedic meditation, which is where it's transcendental meditation, but it's not with the copyright. It's just been passed down from
the Vedas.
Exactly. And, mm-hmm. And so you get a mantra.
Okay.
And it's a mantra. You never speak it out loud or anything like that. And it's a sound that mimics, and you get one, it's a secret, your mantra. You never tell it to anybody. Mm-hmm. But there's only a certain set of them, and they've been passed on, and they're sort of based on your age and name. And the sound mimics nature. And the word mantra, I believe, means something, word vehicle or sound vehicle. Mm. And what I noticed the first time I ever did it and like said the mantra very just lightly in my mind is that it just took me and it dropped me down in.
Mm.
And a peace started happening. And so this kind of meditation, which you do, and they plunge you right in, you do 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the afternoon. I, from the very beginning, have had almost no resistance to doing it.
Wow.
And most people find that they can do it. And one of the reasons that I was curious about investigating it was because I noticed that the people that I knew that did this kind of meditation or transcendental meditation, TM, stuck with it. You know, like I read David Lynch obviously is like a huge proponent for it, but like, you know, I read Jerry Seinfeld had been a Vedic meditator for 40 years. And when you meet people that have this particular meditation practice, you start it and you keep at it.
Wow.
Of course you can fall off, but the fallout rate is so much less than other meditations I've noticed. And so that's what made me curious. I was like, what is it that makes all these people able to meditate for that long? Because I can't. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And the moment, the first minute that I ever did it, I was like, oh, this is what crazy. Wow. Totally so changed my relationship with it.
I mean, it sounds wonderful. And I have been, I've done meditation. I mean, I was doing yoga for a long, long time. I've done meditation. But for me, my walks are my meditation in many ways, you know,
yeah.
When I'm just lost in thought, I'm just gone, yeah. You know, maybe even showering sometimes is a form of meditation.
Sure.
You know, it's like, but I mean, this
listening
sounds,
listening to music. Yeah.
Listening to music is very, you know, meditate, but I have been looking to, I mean, because I feel
you're gonna
like,
love this.
This sounds,
you're going to love this. I want to introduce you to my meditation.
Please.
Teacher.
I would. I mean, what a gift it would be. I would so love that.
You're
because
love
I've been
it.
Looking for it. I've been looking for it. So this is
good.
This was like meant to be then.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This, and for anyone else who's listening, like if there's any like, you know, TM center that teaches you this kind of meditation, I really can't recommend it highly enough. I will say that if you're the person that said, I can't meditate.
Yeah.
This might be the meditation that changes that and wow. And really kind of just improves your life.
Where can people go and find it? Is there a website? I mean, what do they Google?
Sure. Like- yeah. They can go to, the handle is always Anna Kaja for Instagram, for Twitter. And then Anna Kaja Official is my website. And really, if you want to know what I'm up to, the best place to go is to IMDb.
Okay. But, and what about the Vedic, like the Vedic transcendental meditation you're talking about? How do people
yeah.
know that?
Yeah, I would look up my meditation teacher, if you're in LA,
yeah.
although actually now I think he might be teaching them online. His name is Chris Pomeroy. And his website is thecalmplace.com. And then you can also look up his teacher, and his teacher studied directly with the Maharishi, who was the guy that the Beatles went and studied with. And he's, this guy's amazing. And his name is Tom Knowles, and Knowles is spelled, Tom is THOM. And
yeah.
Knowles is also spelled differently. KNOLES, I think. And he's great too. And they'll, you know, if you email them, they'll direct you to the right place. It's
wow.
Might be the beginning of something special.
That sounds, I mean, it sounds so lovely. You know, I know what it is that also, you know, when you grew up in a pretty conservative Muslim household, you know, meditation is not really something that is you grow up with. I didn't discover meditation until I was an adult. Like I started doing yoga and I was like, oh my God, yoga. I mean, I used to do vinyasa yoga like 3-4 times a week. And
yeah.
I used to have these crazy sugar cravings and yoga fixed it for me.
I believe it.
Yoga.
I love you. I do yoga. I do yoga every day too.
Oh, good for you. Do you do vinyasa? What do you do?
I just do regular like power vinyasa yoga, you know? Okay. I do a bunch of sun salutations, downward dogs, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
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 And when you do these meditations every day for 40 minutes.
And it's 20 in the morning and 20 in the afternoon.
Well, 20 in the morning and 20 in the afternoon. Do you have epiphanies while you're doing these meditations?
All the time.
Wow. Wow.
All the time. It's crazy. And the thing is, you're really not, you're supposed to be focusing on the mantra, but like you wander off into thought and that's fine. That's the other thing. I just want to say this about meditation is a lot of people say like, I can't stop thinking. And one of the things that my meditation teacher told me early on is like, heart beats, your lung breathes. That's its job. Your brain's job is to think.
Yeah, exactly.
You're gonna think. Nothing about meditation has to do with stopping thinking.
That's right.
Get that out of your head, because if you're gonna try to stop thinking, you're good luck, you know?
Right.
But you keep refocusing. Mm-hmm. When you remember, you bring it back. And we say it's a perfectly imperfect practice.
Mm-hmm.
If you did it, if you sat for the 20 minutes and tried, it's working. That's it. And I have an epiphany. Things will come to you. Things will just kind of like rise up.
Right. You know, I wanted to actually ask you real quick and then we'll wrap up because I know you said that you have to be done by 7:30.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you real quick. These meditations, do you feel like when you're in stressful situations or something, God forbid, something very tragic had happened or something very shocking has happened, that you remain a lot calm because of these meditations, or they ground you in that way?
Yes. Not not always, you know, like if I've had a super stressful day and I haven't meditated in 10 hours, maybe I'm not my most, James. Maybe I'm not my most calm. Maybe I really need to meditate, right? Like, it's not like I'm a person without anger now.
It's not like I don't
turn into a bitch every once in a while, but have I found that to be true? I won't go into the details, but I had an experience just this weekend where I was like, I don't even know what happened, how I dealt with that situation. I would never have dealt with that situation that way. It just arose in me, this like, I was able to do something that I normally wouldn't have been able to do. And I find that to be the case more and more, that it's almost like there's the space inside you to think before you speak, maybe a little bit more, or somehow a compassion occurs to you a little more often. Not always, but a little more often, right?
Yeah. So. I would say that as an artist, for me, more and more, and I think even as an artist, but more, I think as a human being, I've made it a point where there's only one kind of people that are welcomed in my life, or especially in my inner circle. If you do not come from a place of love and compassion and kindness, you don't need to be in my inner circle. You can just stay on the outer circle. We don't need to talk. Like, it's fine. And I think the older I get, the more I really, really value that, because I see how it has this ripple effect on other things and other people. So I kind of make it a point to, you know, be with kind people. That's like my thing, you know?
Yeah.
Anna, this was such a fun conversation.
Mona, I have to tell you, you are just incredible. I mean, I just feel like this flew by for me, and I feel so close to you.
Oh my God, I feel.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm sitting over here. I mean, we are both in West Hollywood.
That's true, we are.
but I really feel like it's just been so wonderful to like sit across the table and get to know you and tell you about myself. It's amazing.
Yes, thank you so much. Yeah. Same here. I hope one of these days we'll go grab coffee since we're neighbors.
I hope so too.
I mean, and also I'm fully vaccinated. I don't know about you, but I'm definitely fully vaccinated.
I've got one more coming up, but
one more. Okay, so that
we're almost there.
We're gonna be safe. Are you gonna be flying out soon for your project?
Yeah, I'm flying out probably in about 18 days.
Oh, so you're here for a bit.
Yeah, we'll go get coffee.
Okay, let's go get some coffee. Anna, and people can follow, can check your stuff out, AnnaKajaOfficial.com.
Yep.
And what about your socials?
Anna Kaja. Okay. Kaja.
Fullspin.
And really, if you want the most up-to-date stuff, go to IMDb and just put my name in.
Anna, I know you're shooting this project that you can't talk about, but do you have any projects right now that are playing, that are on TV or something?
I mean, there's a film that's making the rounds of the film festivals that I'm really proud of. It's called Definition, Please. It's a feature film.
Okay.
I just had an episode of The Resident air that I had a great time shooting in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And then this thing that I can't talk about will be like, it'll be like several episodes of a show that I'm just really excited to be a part of.
Yeah.
And then I'll have some really good news, I think, coming out about on the writing front as well.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, I can't wait to talk more and catch up with you. So we're gonna do the next one in person.
Yes, please.
Anna, I had such a great time. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time.
Oh, of course. Great talking to you.
Great talking to you too. I'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Bye.
That was a lovely Kaja, you guys. I had a great, lovely, lovely conversation. Oh my God. I learned so much about Vedic transcendental meditation. I cannot wait to do it. I hope you guys meditate. I hope you guys look into that. Anna was kind enough to share with us the calmplace.com, which I highly recommend you guys go check it out. If you are into meditation and want to get into meditation, I mean, God knows we've lived through freaking chaos and we can all use some meditation in our lives. You guys have a lovely weekend. If you haven't subscribed to my YouTube channel, please do. You can go to youtube.com/MonaShakeComedian, same name on Facebook and TikTok, and you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Mona's Comedy. Have a lovely weekend. Stay safe out there. Wear your masks. Get your vaccinations. Have a good night.